And we're very excited to have you here tonight for our MBA admissions consultant panel. Again, a couple logistics. If you need to go to the bathroom, don't stay here. Go to the bathroom in the back. People outside will direct you to the necessary facilities. Also, we will be powering forward without breaks, so do make sure you plan for that. Also, we will be taking questions at the end. The structure of tonight's panel is a series of case studies. And at the end of those case studies, we will have time for questions. But during them, if you would just hold your questions, that would be great. So without further ado, let's go ahead and get started. I will introduce our panel to you. First, to my left, we have Jeremy Scheinwald from MBA Mission. We also have Graham Richmond from ClearAdmit. We have Chioma Isiadinso from Expertus, and Katie Malachuk from Stacey Blackman Consulting. So how do these case studies of hypothetical students work? Let me just back up for a second and say, you sometimes come to these panels and you hear admissions officers talk, and that's great, from the different schools. You can learn a lot from them, and I personally like them. But if you go to those panels thinking that you're improving your chances of getting into business school by collaring them afterwards and saying, remember my name, you're a little insane. I hate to say it. The only way you can really change your chances of admission is by becoming so memorable through you could have some behavior that might make yourself memorable in the wrong way to an admissions officer. So we've got something even better for you tonight. We have the people who are going to help you get into business school. So rather than have each of them talk about what their company does for 2 hours, what we decided to do was create a set of case studies around hypothetical students. These are all based on real cases or on examples cobbled together from multiple people. So let me make a couple of points. One, there's going to be something of artificiality when we role play these things out. Your first meeting with an admissions consultant will not necessarily yield all the same magical insights that we will have tonight. But they are based on real cases. We wanted to design them to explore certain critical questions, such as, where, when, and in fact, maybe even why am I applying to business school? What can I do before applying to improve my chances of getting in? And how can I make my applications better? In some cases, we will have postscripts. In a couple of the case studies, they were based really around one person. And the consultant in that case will talk about what happened to that person subsequently. In other cases that are more composites, there won't be a postscript. But in each case, we will have a number of takeaways, a number of strategies that you can think about for improving your chances. So what are B schools looking for? Just to quickly review this, we asked the admissions consultants to send us some of their thoughts, and we categorize these under three big categories, which should not be too surprising to you if you are probably where you are in the admissions process by this point. So one is around academics, right? So where you went to undergrad and how rigorous that was, a record of taking difficult classes, of course, your GPA, any accolades or honors, awards that you've gotten. Technical proficiency in, say, a computer language or something. What's missing from here? What haven't I gotten to? GMAT, of course. GMAT's part of that, right? And if necessary, the TOEFL. Second broad area, career history and goals. So where have you been? Where are you going in your career? So are they clear? Is it personally driven? Is it well thought out? Can you contribute unique work experience to the classroom? Do you have a realistic idea of what an MBA can do for you? And lastly, references, your work references, do they highlight the right characteristics. The third component are those personal and professional characteristics, such as leadership, of course, your team skills. Anyone interested in Duke in Fuqua? That's where I went to school, and they talk about Team Fuqua all the time, so go ahead and put teamwork on your application if you're going to Duke. Ethics, insight, guts. You need to have all those things. Humble yet confident, and that really comes from having a purpose, having a direction. A tangible passion for getting an MBA and having it apply to your career. And your extracurricular involvement. What kinds of ways do you influence your community around you? So this is just a quick review, an overview of some of the areas that you should be thinking about demonstrating in your application. So with that, we will now turn to Jeremy, who will introduce his company. And I'll load up the slides while you say hello.
Okay, because we're recording, I'll use the mic. Okay. First of all, I just want to thank Chris and Rebecca and everyone at Manhattan GMAT for hosting this event. They all worked very hard at it, and you can tell by the fact that that we have a packed house that it's already quite a success. And also just say what an honor it is to be sharing the stage with some colleagues and now friends who we've had the chance to meet. And finally, to thank all of you for coming here this evening. It actually became quite a beautiful day, and I'm sure there are a lot of patios that are beckoning you, so I'll try to keep this brief. That way you can enjoy some academics and then some gin and tonics. MBA Mission was founded, I suppose, with a pretty simple principle that there's no typical candidate and that every single candidate can be differentiated, that we can work with candidates to find the unique stories within their histories and their experiences, and indeed, you know, as we've met admissions officers in different events from, you know, all around the world, quite literally, you know, I think we've essentially come to have that corroborated by them. And our entire modus operandi is wrapped up in the belief that we can differentiate our candidates. And if you look at an application, it could be, you know, 20, 30, 40 pages by the time you press submit, and all of it is written. Your 99% of your entire application process will be written. You'll have a half an hour interview, possibly, at some of the schools. But really, you're writing to them saying, let me in. And our bias as a firm is towards writing. And every single consultant at our firm, I'll let you drive. Every consultant at our firm is a professional writer. And that's not to suggest we're going to write your essays for you, but fundamentally we understand what makes a good story, and we understand how to use your story to differentiate you. So whether it's my foundation, Jeremy Scheinwald, I put myself at the bottom as a humble leader, I suppose. My foundation is as a speechwriter for the ambassador of Israel to the United States, or Brian Eng, who's a Wharton grad and wrote for the Emmy Award-winning McLaughlin Group, or Monica Carpenter-Okra, who wrote a book while at Harvard Business School, 65 successful Harvard Business School application essays, with some colleagues as well. And so we really use the written word to help you understand your story and differentiate yourself. The next thing I would say, and I don't want to go through our entire process, but you know, I think that it's important to note that we take a package approach. We really believe in unlimited creativity, the idea that you can continue working, whether it's your fifth draft or your 15th draft. Our idea is that, you know, that you're going to continue working until your product is as strong as it's going to be. And that includes brainstorming two-on-one, because your ideas are so fundamental to differentiating you. We always have two consultants brainstorming with candidates to help discover the stories that make candidates truly distinct. And thereafter, you work with one dedicated consultant who, again, is a professional writer who will help you craft your own story. And finally, I would just say that we take pride in the fact that we're a boutique firm. We're not Walmart yet. I'm not sure that we aspire to be. And I think that allows us to have a real high-touch, high-feel experience with all of our candidates. And with that, I think that I've used my allotment of time, so I'll turn it back over, and we'll roll the dice with the first case. Or I guess I'll.
Okay. So as we load up the first case, let's see here. I am Antonio.
You'll see from Antonio's profile that he's got. Great. You'll see from Antonio's profile, he's got a nice solid GMAT at 700, balanced, a nice balanced score. His grades are solid or above average for most schools. He went to a very respectable state school, and has 2 years working in the restructuring group as in iBanking. He's a white male, and he moved to Italy. He moved from Italy when he was a youngster, and so quite incredibly, I don't want to be too negative. but he's actually, with what we have here, he's got problems in that he comes from an incredibly competitive group of candidates. And so I think the concept here is that we'll start to work with him to understand how he can differentiate himself. So Antonio, I guess let's start. Why don't we review a little bit of your background in the restructuring group? How have you been doing professionally to date?
I've been doing pretty well. I started 2 years ago, and I've been about middle upper of my class, and have enjoyed it. Mm-hmm. I've enjoyed the aspect of the deal when the deal gets done.
Right, so strong reviews, middling reviews.
mostly reviews. Strong. Not everybody loves me.
Right.
But
okay. And so now after 2 years, you're considering going back to school. And
yep.
I mean, what's your impetus for going back to school now? Why not a third year? What are you thinking?
Well, the market right now isn't so great.
Right.
So it seems like maybe it's a pretty good time to
right.
look at it. And I guess I could think about a third year, but I was thinking of it all along as 2 years and then go back to school.
Right. So what would you say some of your ambitions are going forward? Because you can differentiate yourself not only based on the past, but also based on the future. If you have some remarkable career goals that seem quite plausible, then that might help you.
Well, I guess I was just thinking I would stay in finance to show continuity to the admissions people, and that's what I've been doing.
Right.
So.
And so, have you given any thought to how that could be what area you'd want to go back to if you're going back to finance, some sort of even differentiating within finance?
Well, I don't know. I guess maybe I'll tell you what I around the when we do a restructuring, what I find really interesting is not even so much getting the deal done as looking at what the operational people on the business side are going to have to do. I mean, what we do is we help restructure companies that are in bankruptcy or in other kinds of trouble. And so we arrange the financing for them, and that's all well and good, but it's other people that are going to take the operational goals that we set, the numbers in the spreadsheet, and go make them happen.
Right.
And so,
I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, but it would seem to be suggesting that you're more interested in actually working with the companies than you are with continuing in banking.
Yeah, actually, that's probably true.
Okay.
I mean, like you take a company like a textiles company. There are a lot of those in bankruptcy or in receivership or something.
Right.
And they got to actually make new goals. They have to go in and sell their product. They have to cut costs in a rational way. I mean, that's interesting. But, I guess I would like to do that, but I've got 2 years of finance experience. I want to get into school.
Right. I mean, so. I think that there's you don't have to feel obliged to follow your previous career path or any particular goal that you think the admissions committee will appreciate. I think you have to sort of create a connection between where you've been and where you're going and why that's important to you. somewhat spiritual life level, as opposed to picking, you know, what you think someone else wants to hear. And that's definitely something that we encounter a fair amount. And there's no profession that a school, you know, wants to hear from you. They want to know that you're going to be a success, and that passion would suggest that success. So I think that if you're interested in old-fashioned business like textiles, that could be quite different, because I don't think that many other people are going to be interested in the textile business.
Yeah, well, that's actually my dad's background. I mean, when we moved here from Italy, we moved to North Carolina because my dad worked in the textiles industry. And so that's how we wound up here.
Right, and what's great about that is you have a restructuring background, and then you have this kind of personal family connection to these goals, which I think adds quite a bit of momentum behind it, which is going to be quite appealing. So I think that's great. I noticed as I was looking through your profile, I didn't see any community activity up there. I'm guessing you're a busy banker.
Yeah, I don't have any time. As I was thinking, I saw that too several months ago,
right,
that I had zero. So I don't know. I did something, I guess, so stereotypical. I went out and I had heard about Big Brothers. So I became a Big Brother, and now I'm a Big Brother. And I've been a Big Brother for the last, I don't know, like 3-4 months or something. Okay. And
I mean, one thing I would say is that with only 2 years out of school, it's possible that if you did something remarkable at UNC, that, you know, we could access that as a significant story. Mm-hmm. So, you know, we can definitely go into that. But in terms of 4 months as a Big Brother, tricky. You know, certainly nothing that I think, you know, is immediate as an impact. But
right,
you know, it depends really on what you've done with your big with your little brother, and the kind of impact you've had on him. Because really, the quality of your story with him is what's going to make your story high quality. You know, if you've just gone out for beers with your little brother, then you're definitely not going to get in. But if you've had consistent contact and you're already seeing some changes, then I think that I think that you might have a story there potentially. You know, it's something that is difficult to pin down immediately.
You know, it's funny because I have to be honest. I did it for the, you know, to sort of pad my resume, but I've actually taken to my little brother, Raymond. I've gotten more into the whole thing than I thought I would.
Right.
But I feel really guilty about that, because I feel guilty about, like, writing about this at all.
Right.
You know, because now it's like that I actually mean it. I kind of feel bad talking about it, if you know what I mean.
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
Yeah, I know what you mean. But I think that if there's a sincerity of your effort and we can see a change in this individual in a short period of time, that could potentially mitigate the short period of time that you've worked with them. I'm not guaranteeing anything, but if we can see that, if the sincerity can really come through, you know, in the next little while, I think that's great. And if you've really made a commitment to him, you know, we could work with that.
I mean, I want to continue working with him, you know, seeing him until such time as I leave this city, you know, so I want to have a long-term relationship with him.
That's great.
So,
yeah.
So, yeah.
Okay. And then you know, beyond that, I mean, you mentioned that you're originally from Italy. Do you still have your Italian citizenship?
Is this actually, I have dual citizenship.
Okay.
I was born in Milan, and I moved here in high school. So I still have a lot of relatives back in Italy, and actually there's even ancestry in France. So,
I'm guessing is Italian still the language of your home?
Actually, yeah, we speak Italian, but also speak English, and so I speak both. And I read French.
You read French. So, how did you manage to come about reading French and not speaking it?
That's a good question. My grandfather was French, and when I was a sophomore in college, I was back at my grandmother's home in Milan, and she had this book that my grandfather wrote. He's no longer alive, and he wrote it in French, but all my generation, none of us speak French, and And so I was looking at this book, and I just felt like, because it was sitting there covered with dust, and I decided to say, you know, hey, Nona, I'm going to try reading this. Right. And so I learned French to read my grandfather's honestly not so great novel. But
sat there with a French English dictionary as you read.
Yeah, but yeah,
went that's through a, it. I mean, that's a pretty unusual personal story. You know, there are lots of people, you know, I think who, especially for some people who might be a little lighter on community service, who, you know, who might have a personal story to tell to balance things out. You know, that's mm-hmm. a story that, you know, that would suggest intellectual curiosity. Hmm. It would suggest some fundamental values, appreciation for your history, you know, respect for your grandmother, etc. Maybe some adventuristic tendencies, you know, all those types of things. I mean, if you look at your schools, you know, it might make a good foil to a deal story for one of your three achievements at Harvard, mm-hmm. or it could make for an interesting piece of, an interesting tidbit to throw into your slides for Chicago. And it's something that, you know, no one else, as far as I know, as I look out into this crowd, I'm guessing that no one else here has a similar experience, and it's something that could really catch someone's attention. So I think that it's something that you probably shouldn't cast aside.
Okay. I've never put it on a resume before.
Yeah, you know, there's certain things that don't fit nicely into a box, but they can fit nicely into a narrative. So it certainly is something to consider.
Okay.
And these are, you know, these and other stories are worth exploring. You know, you have your own family history as well. You know, what it was like to move to a new country. And
yeah.
again, you know, that's far in the past, and it might not necessarily work, but it's definitely something to explore, mm-hmm. because the schools want to know you as more than just your GMAT scores and your middling analyst job, middling to good, exactly, and your 4 months of being a big brother, which is still great.
Great. Okay, so I think then that's Antonio, and we have we have some takeaways that we can throw up on the board now. Why don't you do it?
Okay. Let's,
so
and
it's,
you advance it.
I will advance it.
I don't show them my blood egg tendency. Okay. I mean, I think if you look at this, you know, hopefully the first point that you got out is you don't have to be anyone. It sounds like something your mom might say to you, but it's the truth. Attempting to be something that you're not passionate about, you're going to lack the sincerity in your essays, and you're not going to stand out. This individual seemed to be quite sincerely passionate about restructuring in an old-fashioned industry. That's to me is much more powerful than a blasé attitude towards finance that will come out via essays and via an interview for sure. It's very difficult to fake that kind of passion. The second is indeed, you know, write about recent activities. But keep them in perspective. And, you know, you have to have a very, very powerful story if it's something you started recently. And in this case, we don't know. I mean, we can see we've got a reformed man here in Antonio who's come to community service late and has really appreciated it. And maybe that passion can translate into quite a sincere story if that person can show, you know, very thorough examples. The jury's out on that one, but the idea is that, you know, you don't have anything to be ashamed about or feel like, you know, you have to make excuses for if you've started your community activities, you know, in the not so distant future. And finally, the last one, and this is one that we really focus on, you know, and some people are going to have the stories and some people aren't, but it's something very, very much worth exploring with everyone because, you know, again, I'm going to sound like a mom, but you know, you're distinct, you're different, and you know, there are a lot of people who have the deal story and not a lot of people who have, you know, who have the story of learning French to read their grandfather's book, which is actually a real life example, so it's not as far fetched as you would think. And you know, the things that have made you who you are, and the adventures you've had in your life are all fair game. And a lot of them are adventures that other people won't necessarily have gone on. You just need to really, really look for them, and they can be a moment in time, they can be a month long or a year long experience. But for almost everyone, there's something there, and it's definitely, again, worth exploring. So with that, I think I've used my allotment.
Okay, great.
Thank you very much. And
thanks,
I'll
Jeremy.
Back over to Chris.
Okay. And a round of applause for Jeremy. We will, again, please hold your questions. And next up, we have Graham Richmond. You can take, let's see. And then just to the right. That one there.
Oh, can you launch it? Can you launch the
desk? Sorry.
Hi, everyone. I just wanted to first start by kind of echoing Jeremy's sentiments. Thanks so much for coming. Thanks to Manhattan GMAT for setting this up. I'm going to be very brief about what ClearAdmit does and how we do it, because I think the interesting part about tonight's activity is this sort of investigation of real or sort of composite profiles so that you can see how this process works of positioning yourself as an MBA applicant. So I'll just sort of jump in. In terms of my own background, I'm the co-founder of ClearAdmit. I have an MBA from the Wharton School. I also worked for Wharton as an admissions officer, not just as a student while I was there, but as a full-time job when I graduated. So I have a lot of experience of both kind of the applicant perspective, student perspective, as well as an admissions officer perspective. So that's me, and now let's talk a little bit about what we do at ClearAdmit. The first sort of element that we focus on is preparation. And that's really defined by assessing your candidacy, you know, knowing what are your strengths and weaknesses, learning, sort of delving into your background, and doing a lot of what you're seeing tonight, you know, talking with the candidate, understanding what they bring to the table. Because you can't really start this process until you understand sort of who you are and what you have to offer. Once you know that, you can then begin to think about, okay, you know, these are the components of my background that I bring to the table. How am I going to position them in the MBA admissions process? You know, which stories am I going to use in which essays? And, you know, what am I going to talk about in the interview, et cetera? Then once we've talked about your background, your positioning, your dreams, your goals, what you want to do after business school, you can then begin to think about school selection. And we do a lot of work around this, and I think that one of the problems that I see in MBA admissions is that most people who come to ClearAdmit, they already have an idea of what schools they want to go to, and it's really only upon examining their actual career goals and delving deeper into the programs that they understand that, you know, maybe that I pick the top five schools from Business Week idea is not the best approach to choosing a school. We help you with deadline planning, and, you know, that's pretty important because everyone's working, and applying to business school is almost a full-time job. So as far as execution is concerned, that's kind of the sort of middle phase of the work that we do. We'll review your resume. We do a lot of, obviously, our staff are all liberal arts background, you know, great writers with admissions expertise. And so clearly we do a lot of reviewing of anything you're going to submit to a business school. And so essay editing, resume reviews, recommender coaching. So a lot of recommenders will actually communicate directly with ClearAdmit. They'll send us the letter they've written for you. We'll give them feedback, making sure that it's supportive. In some cases, if they've shared the letters with you directly, we'll look at those as well. Interview preparation. So we do a lot of mock interviewing. The interview is actually a pretty critical part of this process. It depends on the school, but there are programs where the interview could be viewed as sort of the final hurdle. And I see far too many candidates who sort of go 110% in the admissions process when it comes to essays and then sort of blow off the interview and don't think that it requires preparation, and that can be a real mistake. And then beyond that, once you've got sort of your results, we work a lot around matriculation consultation, so helping you decide, you know, which program should you actually attend, and then dealing with things like, you know, financial aid. And obviously for those people who, you know, don't get in or get waitlisted, we deal a lot with waitlist strategy. There are a lot of people who come to ClearAdmit just for a report after they've applied on their own and have been unsuccessful. So that's kind of what we do. How we do it, I mean, we have a lot of sort of in-house knowledge. Our staff have a lot of MBA admissions experience. So I'm a former Wharton admissions officer. Deanna Merowitz, who's actually in the room tonight in the back, is a Columbia Business School admissions officer who joined our team a year ago. And so we have a lot of MBA admissions experience on our staff. And then we have a great deal of institutional knowledge. I think some of you received Clear Admit school guides when you came in. And so over the years, we've built up a lot of knowledge by publishing these types of guides and actually working with candidates through the process. And then we have a lot of inside information, and that's because we have strong relationships with the MBA admissions officers at the leading schools. Part of that comes because our staff has backgrounds in admissions, and so in a sense, we're reaching out to former colleagues when we have questions about the process. And then obviously, most of the folks on our team have MBAs too, and so we have that perspective of what was it like when we applied. And I try not to think about it, but it's a challenge, and so it's good to have that perspective as we counsel folks. We take a really personalized approach to our services. So I think many of you have probably seen our website, which seems like this sort of vast thing that reaches out across the world, and a lot of people read our blog and things. The reality is that we actually only work with a small number of people one-on-one each year, and we've chosen to keep that part of our business small because we take a really personalized approach, and we just don't feel that it's possible to serve everyone. So there's that element. We also, you know, have sort of comprehensive offerings, as I described earlier. You know, we'll work with you on every aspect of this process to make sure that, you know, you don't make that sort of fatal mistake when it comes to the, you know, the interview. Writing and editing expertise, you'll see from the bios of the counselors on our website that, you know, we've got a lot of graduates from leading schools as kind of liberal arts backgrounds, Yale, Swarthmore, programs like that. And so we try to bring that expertise to the equation as well. The final thing is we're a member of AGAC. We actually co-founded AGAC, which is the Association of International Graduate Admissions Consultants. And actually, everyone on this panel belongs to AGAC. And it's basically an organization that has set ethical standards in the MBA and graduate admissions consulting space, meaning, you know, we don't write essays for candidates. And this was actually born out of a presentation that Clear Admit and some other firms made to the schools at the annual GMAC conference. So we've tried to set standards. And I think that brings us to the next candidate.
So I'm now, instead of Antonio, I'm Barbara now. So we were actually thinking of getting me a Marge Simpson wig for this, but we thought that might be a little over the top.
You don't really look how I expected, Barbara.
Yes, I drank a lot last night.
So let's start with talking about your background in terms of the way that the schools are going to look at it.
Okay.
So schools are interested in accepting candidates who can excel academically mm-hmm. in the program, who have an interesting career path, not only, you know, kind of where they've been, but where they're going next, and who are going to contribute to the MBA community when it comes to kind of getting involved in clubs and campus events.
Okay.
So let's look at your profile in kind of those three areas, starting with academics.
Okay.
So tell me a little bit. I mean, we've got, you know, on the board here, we can see that, you know, you went to Wesleyan and you studied history, and you had a 3-2.
Yeah.
Any idea on your class rank?
Class rank sort of within department or...
No,
across
ideally
everybody.
Across everyone.
Ooh, I guess that includes some people who were in tougher majors than I took at that particular school. Mm-hmm. Nothing against anyone from Wesleyan history. This was just made up. I was sort of middle, I would say 60th percentile. How about that?
Okay. So... I guess, I mean, as far as your academics are concerned, as you may know, a 3-2 is sort of on the lower end of the average GPA at the top MBA programs in terms of accepted students.
Can I just add 0.3 to that? Make it a 3.5?
No.
Okay.
You know, and in fact, you're going to need an extra digit.
Most
of the schools ask for, you know, 3.2
something.
Okay. But in any event, I think your GPA is, it's a little on the low side, although I will say, you know, Wesleyan's a good school.
Yeah.
And you do get points for that. So, in fact, you know, sometimes schools will actually make comparisons in the sense that, you know, oh, this person has a 3.5 from Yale, this person has a 3.8 from Central Utah State University, mm-hmm. vocation, whatever. Okay. Mm-hmm. So they'll actually, you know, keep that in mind.
Okay.
So
okay.
I think I'm not actually that concerned about your GPA.
Okay.
It's a little low. there is this aspect of the fact that you studied history, which on the one hand is going to be really intriguing, right?
Right.
I mean, there aren't that many history majors applying to business school.
Yeah. Well, I loved it. I mean, I really liked it.
And so there's you get this sort of it's kind of an added, oh, this person's unique or non-traditional because you didn't study business administration or engineering as
right.
an undergraduate. But then you're going to strike panic in the hearts of the admissions team because they're going to wonder how good you are at math. And so tell me a little bit about your GMAT score, 670, huh? And what do those arrows mean with the math?
Those arrows mean, I'm not really good at math, but two...
Greater than...
Two less thans.
What was your percentile?
Yeah, it means really lower.
So what was your percentile on the math portion?
Can I tell you my percentile on the verbal first?
Sure.
Okay,
yeah.
It was 97%. I mean,
excellent.
I rocked the verbal.
And
They've
actually found that the verbal percentile is a more accurate predictor of your first year performance in business school than the math.
Wow.
But
that's great.
But the schools don't listen to that. So
okay.
So what was the math percentile?
Less than 97. Was in the high 50s.
High 50s. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. What about quantitative coursework at school? I mean, you went to Wesleyan and presumably you had to take some things outside of history. Did you take any math or econ?
I took one econ course.
And how'd you do?
I got a B.
Okay. So I think... You know, if looking at your profile from an academic standpoint, I think there's going to be some concern. I mean, the committee is going to sort of say, well, we don't have enough data from undergrad, you know, one course and a B. And then the GMAT, how many times have you taken the test?
Actually, that's my third time. And I'm terrible at standardized tests. And I was amazed to get a 670. I sort of went to the upper end of, I guess, what they call the bell curve by accident. So so I absolutely lucked out. I got a 550, then a 610, and then 670. A 670 because I rocked the verbal. And
now, did you work with Chris Ryan at Manhattan GMAT to get that 670?
No. I bought a Kaplan 800 book.
Okay.
Don't do that.
I think what we have here is it's clear to me that you probably don't want to retake the GMAT again.
And
it doesn't sound
like
you want to.
No,
not something you enjoy doing.
Not something I can't even contemplate going back into the GMAT.
So let's assume you have maxed out your potential on the GMAT and that you're just a bad standardized test taker and that maybe you are good in math. You know, you just have this one data point from undergrad.
Yeah.
How could we – I mean, you really need to show the schools though. I mean, because they don't want to admit someone who's at risk of dropping out after the first semester.
Right.
And this kind of thing happens. I mean, when I was working in Wharton as an admissions officer – we'd literally get a list at the end of the first semester of the students who had dropped off, you know, who had poor performance in their quant courses. And what was really crazy is the academic services office would come to us and say, can we take a look at those files and see why you admitted those people?
Wow.
And then I'd have to sort of say, we knew that this might be a problem, but we liked the person and we thought, you know, and they'd say, well, don't do that again. You know, so you need to convince them that you're capable. And so maybe one thing you could do is actually take a class or two. I mean, here we are in New York. You could go down to NYU School of Continuing Ed and take statistics or accounting. I'm sure these sound exciting to you. But, I mean, it would be really helpful. You could show them, kind of give them a current view of your kind of classroom ability today in a quantitative subject. And then you could make that argument in your optional essay. Standardized tests aren't for me, but look, I just got an A in my stats class at NYU. I know what I'm getting into with business school, and I want to be ready. So that's my main concern around your academics.
Okay.
Let's talk about your career background. What is it that you do? I mean, you have your PR.
Yeah, I work for basically the second biggest PR firm here in New York, and I work in the consumer health group, and so we do campaigns with large consumer brands, also pharma doing direct to consumer, and we do campaigns and I love it. I'm absolutely in love with this stuff. And so
using your liberal arts kind of background.
Marketing. And sort of the way in which a campaign comes together is really cool. I'm really a team person, and I love working with lots of people sort of towards a deadline or towards a project.
And what is it that you want to do? Let's imagine that, you know, you go to your business school of choice and you graduate. What's that dream job within reason? You know, what would you like to do after school?
I know that already. I want to do brand management. In fact, we already work with some of the best brands in consumer health. Now I want to continue doing that, but on the client side.
Okay.
And yeah.
So you've had exposure to some of these companies and you want to just cross over that line and see it from the other side.
Yep.
Okay. That sounds great. I mean, that's a feasible career goal. It's also, it sounds like you've given this some thought and the schools, I mean, there's a reason business schools want folks who have kind of clear career goals and a feasible path.
Mm-hmm.
And that's because they want to make sure they can actually get you a job when you graduate.
Right.
They are graded on that and all of these rankings. So, you know, their ability to kind of place graduates and how many offers you got, things like that. So that's a positive. Is there any other component to this? I mean, is there another interest in terms of, you know, a certain type of company or a region?
Oh, right. I see. Well, I am interested to continue in consumer health. I could also see going certain other kinds of brands, but like Coke or something like that. But P&G. Actually, that was one of our campaigns. We did a campaign in Mexico, and I minored in Spanish. And so and have always been really interested. I mean, part of my... It was Spanish, and so I took a lot of courses in Latin American history. I even spent a semester in Mexico, so I was really involved in that campaign at Ruta Finn. So,
and so are you? I mean, would you consider working for Procter & Gamble, you know, in that market specifically?
Oh, yeah,
like
absolutely.
Latin America.
Oh, I'd love to do that.
Vice President of Marketing, Latin America, or something.
Yeah, or like a rotation or something like that. Spend a couple of years down there or something. Yeah.
Okay. I mean, I think that could be a really interesting angle to your candidacy. I mean, just because now you're no longer PR person to, you know, kind of brand management, but there's this added angle, you know, around consumer health or in addition, the sort of language focus. Are you pretty fluent?
Yeah. I mean, as fluent as you can get at the end of a semester in Mexico City when you're sampling a lot of mezcal and tequila. And
okay.
Like
So I think that could be a really great angle to pursue. And actually, along those lines, let's talk a little bit about your school selection. I mean, we'll get to extracurriculars, but I'm curious about school selection because I noticed that you mentioned here Kellogg, HBS, and Michigan.
Yeah.
And I'm kind of wondering how did you – I mean, Kellogg, you're interested in brand management.
Yeah, brand management. So that made sense because they're like number one all the time in brand.
That is a strength that they have, yes.
Mm-hmm.
What about the other two here?
HBS – well, because they're Harvard and my uncle went there.
Oh, okay.
And,
good.
And Michigan because I like the Midwest. I could see living there for a couple of years and maybe settling in sort of Chicago-ish area.
Mm-hmm. I mean, there are a number of consumer packaged goods companies based out of the Midwest.
Right.
So there is that potential angle. Something tells me, though, that in terms of your career goals, you may want to actually explore further some of these schools because it's not only marketing and brand management, but now there might be this international angle, in terms of, what's their strength when it comes to placing people in jobs internationally or what's their strength if they have sort of language offerings. I mean, you may, if you drank a lot in Mexico City and you didn't, you just minored in Spanish, you might need to actually brush up on that,
and so
you might look at a program that has that sort of offering. I mean, one school that's coming to mind is, the sort of dual degree option. So, for example, Wharton has a program called Lauder, where you could pursue Spanish as your language, and it sort of runs in parallel with the MBA curriculum, and they sort of specialize in getting people jobs in the markets that they're targeting. Mm-hmm. So I just as an idea, because sometimes, basing your school selection on sort of where you grew up or brand, kind of recognition or prestige may not be the only way to go. I mean, so you may want to look into the Wharton Lauder program.
Okay.
There are also, I mean, Cornell, the Johnson School has a very interesting sort of brand management focus. So there may be other programs out there for you to investigate. And, depending on how those classes go at NYU, you may or may not be sort of Harvard material, right? I mean, if you really are falling short on the quant side, some of these top programs may be nervous. So that's going to be important. One last thing is what else do you do? I mean, so you obviously go to work and you went to Wesleyan, but what do you do with your spare time?
Like community service, you mean?
That could be one thing. Maybe.
I don't do any community service.
No. Okay. So do you just come home and watch, Sopranos reruns? I mean, what do you do with your spare
time? The Sopranos are good, but well, actually, something I'm into is foreign film, and I didn't just drink in Mexico City. I went and saw a lot of foreign film there, and really got into it in college. And so, yeah, actually, I'm sort of the ringleader of a group of friends and extended friends that we go. It's like a Sunday night movie club, and we go to see the weird movies that no one else sees, and we like rent a house at Sundance and see all the movies that never get released anywhere else. And we did something for Tribeca last year too. So, but I mean, like, that's just for fun.
But I mean, so you haven't thought of introducing that into your candidacy as you apply to business school in some way?
I figured I would actually have to sort of drop that and put some community service on.
Okay. So, I mean, again, remember that the schools are just looking for students who are going to be active contributors to campus life. And while that could involve community service, it could also involve launching an independent film club at Kellogg that, you know, gets together your classmates and goes out to see movies. I mean, there's a lot of components to life on an MBA campus. And, you know, there's another element here, too, which is the schools are looking for people who are well-rounded. They have this belief that in order to be a true leader and kind of, you know, managers of tomorrow, that you should have multiple interests. You know, you have to be the sort of Renaissance woman. And so this element of your profile could actually be an asset in that it shows, you know, kind of intellectual drive and also your organizing. I mean, it sounds like it's informal, but I'm hearing there's a club that meets regularly. You're organizing.
I mean,
trips
we don't have
Sundance.
Like members or something, but yeah, like it's I'm the person who's always doing the work.
I mean, it sounds like it's you know, next best thing to a formal club, and you should consider introducing that into your profile.
Cool.
So I think if you can address this issue with the quant weakness, you'll actually be a very strong candidate. And the only other thing I want to say is that you've probably noticed from looking around that even the very top MBA programs who have the pick of the litter in terms of candidates only manage to get about 35% women. And so as a woman in the pool, you are dramatically underrepresented. And so if you can jump through this hoop on the quantitative side, I think you'd be very attractive to all of these schools.
Cool. Thank you.
We'll be brief on this. Basically the idea with this case was you have a candidate who has a critical weakness. And I think sometimes people don't recognize that the schools really are looking for you to be, you know, at a certain level when it comes to your math skills or even on the verbal side. So the key with Barbara was getting her to address this weakness, because otherwise I think what we found from the discussion is that there is kind of an interesting profile behind, you know, behind the numbers. And then the other thing was, you know, just this sort of angle of, you know, speaking Spanish and wanting to work in an international market, you know, that we kind of teased out as we spoke. And that could be a real differentiator. It also might, you know, kind of shift school selection. And that's why we talked about Wharton Lauder, because of the language component that one could pursue there. And then there's this common theme that is kind of emerging, which is, you don't have to be out there saving the world to prove that you're kind of active or interesting. And so, you know, Barbara's setting up, has run this sort of club that goes to see the movies, and you know, there's an interest there. And there's actually a level of organization and leadership that's going on. And so to the extent that she could formalize that in her application essays and then map it onto future involvement at a given MBA program, she'll really be in kind of the driver's seat. So that's the summary on Barbara.
Thank you, Graham. And now we have Chioma.
How are you guys doing? How's everybody doing? That was a week good. How's everybody doing? Okay, that's much better. I find that with these things, when you go towards the end, you know, you sort of start to have the eyes glaze over a little bit. People fidget, start looking at their Blackberries a little discreetly, and things like that. So let me just put that up front, right? I'm going to try to keep this a little interesting. Expeditors, I'm sure you're wondering, what the heck is Expeditors? What kind of name is that? Anyone want to take a guess?
Russian.
Fair enough, okay. Anyone else? Greek. Greek? Okay. I heard a La word. Latin. Okay. I would say the Latin is very, very close to it. Expert is the word that we created. It doesn't exist. It came from the word expert, and we took the Latin of expert, which is peritus, put it together. But we didn't quite like the sound of experitus. Sounds like something going on in Rome, you know, it's like sacrament or something not quite B-school oriented. So we changed it and created the word expertus. And part of the idea there is to create something that is a bit unique, because at Expertus we take a bit of a different approach with the application process. Let me talk a bit about myself. My passion is admissions. It's helping people figure out what matters to them, getting access to the best schools out there, and hopefully, you know, doing amazing things beyond business school. I've been in the admissions industry for a very long time, a bit over 10 years. I worked for Carnegie Mellon for 5 years, ran the admissions office there at the School of Public Policy for 3 years. And after that, worked for Harvard Business School for 2 years and ran different programs, including their Yield, their waitlist programs, and things like that. Left Harvard and started Expertus. My husband actually went to HBS, so we started Expertus together. And we've been having a fun time with the process. We've met some amazing people from all over the world. I wanted to also talk about the track record. I know my colleagues didn't mention this, but I think pretty much everybody at the table here has a track record of 90% or more. I mean, the process, we're very selective in who we take on. And I say that not in terms of we don't want to roll up our sleeves and get to work. We love to roll up our sleeves and get to work. But at the same time, we want people who are going to work very hard, who want the MBA more than we want it. Okay, so we've been very fortunate to have a 90% success rate. And as I mentioned, the approach that we take at Expertus is one that focuses on personal branding. Business school people have very little time, the MBA board. They've got a few minutes to read an entire application, made up of almost an inch thick. So what does that mean, really? They've got to be able to, in a short amount of time, read through a series of pages and distill your story into a statement. They've got to be able to capture who you are in one or two sentences at the end of a day that summarizes who you are. We call it at Expertus the personal brand statement. The PBS is made up of who you are, what you've done, and where you're headed. And so in working with clients, we always tell them, make sure that whatever you do, figure out how to nail that process. Come up with that personal brand statement, as well as do a brand audit. We don't get into the application at Expertus without actually helping a client go through an entire audit of their life. These MBA boards are interested in getting to know you, not only on a professional level, they really want to understand who you are on a personal level. They want to know what matters to you, what kinds of decisions have you made. And so to a large extent, when they read the essays, what they're looking for is these four ingredients: passion, guts, impact, insight. They want to know that you're really passionate about what you do. They want to know that you've taken risks, not just jumping off skyscrapers or airplanes for the fun of it, but that you've made calculated risks in making your decision. They want to know that you have a track record of success in a lot of different environments. So in other words, you've been successful in one place, there's a very good chance you're going to repeat the success post-B school. And then finally, they want to know that you have awareness about what you've done. That's one of the major mistakes that applicants make when they apply to business school. They do a brilliant job of saying what they've done. The gap that they have is explaining to the admissions board member why they've made all the decisions they've made. They've got to connect the dots. And applicants who have done a very good job of connecting the dots of their story have a compelling brand. So at the end of the day, when the admissions board member finishes reading the application, they can summarize or say something like, oh, that's a turnaround strategy guy. Or that's the serial entrepreneur. Or that's the bridge builder. You're never going to hear an admissions person coming out of their office getting all excited and say, oh, that's a smart, hardworking private equity guy. Or, oh, that's the, you know, phenomenal engineer who's been, you know, cranking out a 3.9.999 GPA. That's not a brand. Certainly, like, your track record of success is positive. The blue chip companies are positive things to have in your story if you have that and play that up. But that is not something that differentiates you. And so at Expeditors, we try to help clients to do a lot of soul searching, a lot of introspection to make sure that what's unique about them comes out in the application. All right, let's talk about the first process is a brand audit. It's a questionnaire that a client will go through. It's a 3-page questionnaire, but by the time they're done with it, in some crazy situations, it turns out to be 30 pages. In other cases, it turns out to be 10 pages. It's really up to the individual. But quite honestly, putting the work into completing the questionnaire, the brand audit, is, in a way, it's doing the work up front. Because what happens is when you've answered all of those very carefully presented questions, the reality is you have a good chunk of your application done right in front of you. So you can literally take the data from the personal brand audit and apply it to a lot of the essay questions being asked. And you did it in a very spontaneous, knee-jerk reaction way. So we get the raw material from you as opposed to the contrived, this is what I think admissions people are trying to hear from us. Okay. Once we do a brand audit, we distill it, figure out what the one sentence that captures who the applicant is. We polish that statement until we absolutely nail it. In addition to that, the applicant, we work on figuring out what their key themes are. For someone, it might be that they're really interested in helping women who have been sort of abused because they've seen other women be abused, maybe in their family, and so they volunteer in the shelters or things like that. For other people, it's entrepreneurship. And entrepreneurship is not really about always starting a company and selling it for $5 million. Entrepreneurship is a mindset. So if you've been able to identify opportunities everywhere you go, or you're the person who's always saying, hey, let's try this, that's innovation, that's entrepreneurship. That might be a theme to your story. I have a client who grew up on a farm. He was the first in his family to go to school. And he's got a lot of firsts to his story. So all of a sudden, one of his themes to his application, one of his brand themes, is the brand theme of firsts. So again, when he's thinking about his application, he's got to think about how to bring that element into his story when tackling whether it's the accomplishment essay that Harvard asks, or, you know, why do you want an MBA, or what matters most to you that Stanford would ask. Okay. So in general, we help the client to figure out what their strategy is. We do an assessment, we figure out the themes, we figure out the personal brand statement. We work on the essays. We don't write them. No one here writes essays for anybody. They wouldn't be part of AGAC, right? We also help them with the interview preparation. You can never overestimate how important the interviews are. And then finally, we also help them in terms of thinking about going to visit campus, making the decision once they've been admitted, and, you know, figuring out even about financing. How do you get the money to fund the MBA? Okay. Let's talk about, we can skip this, I already talked about it. Are you guys interested in hearing examples? I think I kind of touched on that. The Global Citizen is a great example of a personal brand. Ivy Educated is not a good example of a personal brand. So to the left are like the Bootstrapper, that's a brand. Diplomatic Rebel, that's a brand. Hardworking PE Analyst, not a brand. Okay, it's pretty straightforward. Okay, we can move on now.
So if the first person was Antonio and the second person was Barbara, let's put our brains together. What do you think the third person is going to be named? Charles. Exactly. So here we go.
Actually, do you mind if I sit?
Not at all. Yeah, let's switch.
Hello, Charlie.
Hi.
How are you?
Okay, a little nervous.
Yeah, I can understand.
Yeah.
You try to do this in 2 months, huh?
Yeah. Well, I got to crank these things out.
Okay.
You know.
Well, I completely understand.
Yeah.
I think we should probably just stop and take a deep breath.
Okay, I did.
Another deep breath just to relax a little bit.
Oh, that felt good.
Yeah? Good, good. Because I kind of noticed a little bit of tension when you walked in.
Oh, yeah, I'm tense. Yeah. I work in sales and trading. We're tense. This is what we do.
That's what you guys
do. We wake up tense. We fall asleep tense.
Good.
We sleep tense.
Well, we're going to have to work on that whole tenseness a little bit so it doesn't come through in your application.
Okay.
All right. So let's look at your profile, Charlie. So you've got a 3.4 Penn.
Yeah.
You're an econ major. That's pretty good.
Mm-hmm.
You've been working for just about 2 years.
Yeah, and it's been an interesting ride. It's been a tough couple of 2 years. Well, tough right now. I'm a fixed income, and it's bad right now, in case you didn't know.
Is that why you're trying to...
No, I've been thinking about it, but this is one of those impetuses or something.
Okay. Let's just kind of get a little bit more information about you, and then we'll take each of them apart, okay?
Okay.
So this GMAT here... I was wondering if there was a mistake or sort of a misprint. I'm not quite sure.
That should have been a 780. but somehow I'm going to challenge it and see if they. But I don't think it's going to work. So it is a 630.
So we're working with a 630.
We're working with 630 right now.
Okay, and what's the math, verbal breakdown?
Higher math, my verbal, I don't know. I never had a good grammar course, something like that. I'm just miserable. But it is what it is.
Huh, okay. Wow, 10 schools, huh? And you're trying to do 10 schools in 2 months?
Yeah, well, that's how I got into undergrad. I mean, I got to apply the same. I applied to 10 schools, and I got into one. And so I got a 10% chance, and that's what I'm Mr. 10%. I'm the, my brand is Mr. 10%. That's who I am.
So you've been 10 schools, you've been very consistent here.
Yeah, exactly. 10 schools, that's how I'm going to do it. So that's
okay. All right. It seems like it's worked for you in the past,
Yeah.
All those.
Just throw a whole bunch of darts at the wall and see which one sticks. That's because it's a roll of the dice, and so. I figure the more applications, it can only help my chances.
The more applications will help your chances. Interesting. And I see that you're an Asian male. I don't mean to make any assumptions, but that's my assumption.
Yeah.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Well, Charlie, I'm going to be honest with you. I tend to be very direct and blunt with these processes.
Okay.
We've got some problems here. We've got some challenges.
Okay.
So I'm going to sort of break it down for you. I think academically, I am not too concerned. I think in terms of the choice to go to Penn, obviously Ivy, econ is pretty challenging degree. Mm-hmm. The 3.4,
three point four three,
still ballpark 3.4, right? We can't really stretch.
Can't really round it that far.
It is what it is, right?
Yeah.
So we can't really change that. It is whatever the GPA is what it is, right?
Yeah.
All right. It's all right.
Okay.
It's not a wow, right? A 3.8, 3.9 would be a wow.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I'll tell you what concerns me here, Charlie. I think the Asian male GMAT of 6.30 is going to be a significant hurdle to overcome.
Okay.
Just keeping it real.
Okay.
So the question is, what are we going to do about that? What are you thinking about?
I guess I got to retake the GMAT and somehow
retaken.
Yeah, I guess I got to do it. I don't know, in the next 2 months.
Wow.
Somehow.
So you're going to retake the GMAT, crank out 10 applications, each application on average about 4 to 5 essays.
Yeah, but I can cut and paste.
Ah, cut and paste, huh?
Yeah.
That's a bit of a great, interesting, shaky strategy there.
Okay.
Well, let me tell you what I'm thinking, and then you tell me what you're thinking, right? You absolutely should retake the GMAT. No question.
Okay.
And the bar you're really shooting for is 720, 30.
Okay.
Up there. Okay. You happen to fall in a demographic where a lot of people who happen to be male and Asian tend to do very well. They do very, very well on the GMATs. So, in a way, if you were coming from, let's say you were in ballet, you're sort of like a professional dancer, and you've not been working on Wall Street.
Yeah, okay. I got it.
We might sort of make that, make that
I hear what you're cooking.
They're not going to cut you any slack. So you're going to have to retake, okay? Let's talk about this whole strategy about 10 schools, okay? I understand you did it through the darts on the wall. It worked for you. One school worked. But I don't think that's the strategy to go for now, right?
Okay.
I mean, you're talking, you know, a lot of essays, unlike college admissions where you might just do a common application. It's easier to do one school, cut and paste. This school doesn't quite work that way, you know? The schools want you to take the time to answer their essays. The cut and paste strategy, they absolutely will see through it in a second. Even a question that asks the same, you know, when the board member asks the same question, where they say, tell us about your career decision, and somebody else says, walk us through your career, and somebody else says, tell us why you want an MBA. Even the way the question is worded, you have to be very careful that you're answering it the way they ask it, as opposed to just taking a career essay for Wharton, cutting it and dumping it into a career essay for Harvard, and then for Kellogg and Chicago, et cetera. It's not going to work. They can see through that. So I think you're going to have to maybe do a little bit more assessment to figure out how we're going to focus on the essays. I think 10 schools is way too much.
Okay.
You know?
Mm. Well, but, you know,
I don't think you recommend us have time.
You got to convince me there, but because I, you know. But I hear you. I hear you. We'll battle about it.
Would you be more comfortable if we were to create a strategy where we look at schools, given your profile, where you might be able to get in? Because I know you absolutely want to get out of sales and trading, and we'll talk about that.
Yeah, I don't want to stay in sales or in trading.
So this is like your sort of escape hatch?
Yeah.
Okay.
Exactly.
All right, so I would recommend doing a lot of assessment about which schools make sense, given what it is you want to do.
Okay.
We'll talk about that later.
Okay.
Tell me about your goals. Like, okay, so I know you want to escape from sales and trading, but what do you want to do?
I was thinking about consulting.
Consulting.
Yeah.
What kind of consulting?
Management consulting.
Okay. Why management consulting?
Well, I mean, what I do right now, I'm not in love with. I mean, I just, you know, actually, one thing I do is I order lunch for our desk.
Uh-huh.
And then I pay for the lunch and I hand out the lunch, and I don't really like that. And I hear that in consulting they don't do that as much. There's a specific area of consulting that some of the corporate paper that we deal with is distributors and retailers like say a Walmart or a Whole Foods, and I that area of the market I've always been more interested in because I'm more interested in what they do in particular. Like a Walmart, like their supply chain is so fascinating to me. I would love to go and see how they put it all together, or like Whole Foods, how do they get, I mean, just the idea of perishable food getting from one area of the country or the world to somewhere else in time for market, and how you manage that and still make money on, like, you know, tiny margins. I just think it's really interesting. Mm-hmm. So I guess that area, I guess if I had to sort of pick an area, that would be
right.
It.
Right. Are you involved in anything to do with supply chain, you know?
Zero. I mean, I don't have anything, like, it's not part of my job at all. It's just... You know, interested in those companies. Yeah.
Okay. Well, what are you doing outside of work? I mean, that would be interesting to take a look at.
I play basketball with my friends.
Okay.
And I don't really do anything else.
So you have zip leadership at work?
Outside of work. I have been in college, I was like a member of clubs, but I think every club I was a member of, I was just a member of. I can't say I was vice president of something. So, I mean, I always thought that was kind of like, I don't know. I just was never into that. So, so I did some clubs undergrad. I don't really do anything that way now.
Okay.
But
you led, I'm sure you led a project or some initiative that wasn't title driven in undergrad.
Yeah. Well, nah.
Nothing?
I can't think of anything. I mean, I don't really have, I mean... I, you know, had my major, I had my, you know, like, I don't know. I can't think of anything. that I did leadership-wise.
Okay. We're going to have to come back to this.
Okay.
I think overall, Charlie, my recommendation is going to be that you hold up. You know, I know you want to escape. You want to pull that, you know, cord and jump, right?
Yeah.
And jump ship. But I really think that applying with this profile as it is right now for the 10 top MBA programs is just setting yourself up. You know, it's just...
Setting myself up for, like, failure?
Yeah. Yeah.
As opposed to success.
Yeah. Okay. It's not going to work. What I think you can do, I don't think it's a lost cause. I'll tell you what would be a potential strategy here. I think you need to take a year to really plug the holes. There are some gaping holes here.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? So let's start with a GMAT. You know, I think you're going to have to do whatever you can to nail that GMAT. I know you mentioned that you took Kaplan, you know, a couple of times. And I would recommend retaking that GMAT and trying to move it north to 700. Okay?
Okay.
Coursework, you're fine. I wouldn't, you know, with an econ major, you're pretty good. The work thing, I think, would be interesting. Obviously, you have one of two options. You can change jobs. Mm-hmm. If you're going to change jobs, then you're going to have to hold off from applying to B school right away.
Yeah.
You know? So a year wouldn't be enough. You would definitely need to, ideally, work a year and a half so you have enough traction as opposed to change jobs and then apply. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
Because MBA board members tend to look a little bit skeptically at someone who's just sort of, you know, just change jobs just to get into B school. Sometimes they can kind of see through that.
I would probably stay in my job at like go for like a promotion because I'm close. It's like I'm at the 2 year window.
Is that good?
I'm the junior guy. I'm the most junior person on my desk, and they're hiring. We're probably going to get another person, and then you know I'm more senior, and you know, so
you can have them go fetch the coffee, and
so they can get lunch.
Okay,
yes.
Okay. And you can actually do meaningful stuff then.
Yeah. Well, I mean, like I do some meaningful stuff now, but maybe I could do a little bit. I mean, like we're expanding, so I could.
Sure.
You know.
Sure. Okay. Then should we talk?
Okay. So.
All right. So strategies for our friend Charlie here. So Charlie has to absolutely retake the GMAT, which he actually did. This happens to actually be an applicant, and he retook the GMAT and did a Manhattan GMAT course, not to give a plug for Manhattan GMAT, but that's what he did, and he got a 7, I don't know if I've got the figure, but it's like a 710 or 720. The leadership thing was, you know, very, very critical because there was a big gap, but fortunately, you know, he got more aggressive with his work. He couldn't make a jump. He stayed with his job. And that allowed him to get the promotion that he was looking for. And he did get a junior analyst that he could manage. And so several months of managing the junior analyst gave him a little bit of exposure to management experience, which was very, very important. He also worked with interns, began to help out more with the mentoring of interns and things like that. So he was able to beef up his leadership. His personal theme is interesting. He, you know, in sales and trading, the perception is that you're sort of a solo player. You know, you sort of either you're the lowest PO, you don't get that much done, or that you don't work necessarily in a team. You know, compared to like engineers who might be working on a supply, you know, on an assembly line or managing union workers, you're just out there maybe crunching numbers or doing research or analysis. And it was important for him to show that he was a team player, not a solo player, okay? And so with his involvement on the leadership front, it gave him a little bit more exposure to beefing up his team experience. His family stuff was very interesting. He actually moved from the West Coast to the US, to the East Coast. And while all his friends were going to UCLA, he chose to go to Penn, which is a big differentiator because he as I dug in a little bit, I realized that one of the things about him is that he's very comfortable in his own skin. He's not sort of someone who's going to jump on the bandwagon and do what everybody else is doing. And that's actually very important to admissions people. You need to kind of show that you are an independent thinker, that you're making decisions for yourself as opposed to going with the herd. So we were able to work that into his story. He was very big in terms of family values, working closely with his family. So he got to talk about working with his grandmother who was sick and helping her out to get through a tough time. So again, it shows personality, shows compassion, as opposed to somebody who's just in it for the money. And then finally, you know, he, in terms of getting building a bridge between his interest in supply chain and working in sales and trading, he was able to get involved in volunteer activities with City Harvest. And not just sort of like, you know, to ladle soup once every 6 months, but he actually got heavily involved behind the scenes in their operations and began to head up mini teams of volunteers. And that gave him more credibility when he applied and said, I want to go into supply chain management. Okay. And of course, the whole 10 schools, we pared it down. I absolutely refused to do 5 schools. I think 5 schools is more than enough, but some people are really, really nervous about the process. He did 7 schools, and we can look at the outcome. Do we have any page? Okay, and with regards to our friend Charlie here, he actually got interview invites for all seven schools, from Stanford to Michigan, and he got into 4. He went to Chicago. Okay? Thanks.
All right, last one. Everybody just stand up just for a second.
Wait, I was going to lead something official. Okay. Yeah. So I'm Katie Amalchuk, and I'm a consultant with Stacey Blackman Consulting, but the other hat I wear is I'm a yoga teacher. So I do really want everyone to stand up, actually, just for a second. Put everything down. I know it's a pain. There's cups. Okay, so we're just arms by your side. You're standing in Tadasana. No, but I'm just going to have you scrunch your shoulders up by your ears. Scrunch them up, and then draw them down. And just 2 more times. Scrunch them up. Inhale, and then exhale and draw them down. Last time. Inhale, scrunch up, all the way, shoulders all the way up, and then all the way down. Okay. Have a seat. So that's a good one, actually, when you're at your desk. Right? Because you actually, if you scrunch your shoulders up, when you go to release them, you find like another 3 inches of space. You'll be a little taller. So I'm not Stacey Blackman. Stacey lives, I have no idea how to work that. I'm a yoga teacher, so I'm going to let you do that, yeah. Stacey lives in LA. I've been doing this work with her for a few years, so I'll tell you a little bit about my background. Well, I should say first, Stacey started this business about 7 years ago. She went to Wharton undergrad and then Kellogg for business school, and she was working in marketing, and she was helping friends apply to business school and was realizing a lot of the same techniques she was using in marketing she was using with her friends as they were applying to school. And so then she started, as everyone's been talking about, developing brands for them, marketing them, so that's how the business originated. And there we go. So first, I'm going to a little bit about my background. So I went to Harvard undergrad, graduated in 96, and after college, I did Teach for America. So I taught third grade in Oakland for 2 years, and then I was the director of admissions for Teach for America for a couple of years. And I went to Stanford for business school, and after Stanford, which I loved, and afterwards, if people have Stanford questions they want to ask, I'm always happy to talk about it. After business school, I was a consultant with the Boston Consulting Group, which I did not love. Though BCG is a lovely firm, I just don't really like working in offices that much. So I left that a few years ago to do this work with Stacey and to teach yoga. We have about 20, 25 consultants working with us right now. We've all gone to one of the top 5 business schools, and everyone's top 5 are different. So what I mean is Harvard, Stanford, Wharton, Kellogg, Columbia. Actually, another one of our consultants is here tonight, Kevin Williams, who went to Stanford with me. He was in my class and was a fellow performer in the school show. So you can ask him about that in Stanford as well afterwards. So our consultants have either gone to those schools, or we have a few consultants who were admissions representatives at a couple of those schools. Okay, our services. So we have 3 different services that we offer. By far the most popular and the one that most people do when they're doing a first-time application is the comprehensive service, which is where we do everything, as everyone else is describing. So from school selection, some people arrive with, they have their set list. Some people need more help doing their school selections. We just watched a role play around that. And then also helping you organize your school visits if you need information about where you should be going or going to, you know, information sessions in your area. So there's that first part of the strategy, where should you be looking? And then looking at you and your life and your background. So that's the creating of your, you know, personal brand, and then applying that through your recommendations, your essays, your interview, the application itself. The comprehensive service is an unlimited amount of help, and I think that can be really handy as you're going through it. So unlimited essay editing, things like that. We also have an hourly service, which is mostly used for people who just want a specific, there's just a specific part of the application they need help with, so maybe just the interviews, or maybe you're a reapplicant and you just need someone to look at your essays from last year, so that's that. And then we also have an editing service as well, where you just send your essays in for editing. Okay. So the comprehensive approach. So you partner with one of our consultants. I really think that's just the hallmark of our service, is how personal it is. You and your consultant become true partners in crime through this process, and they get to know you incredibly well. And everyone that's working with Stacey is doing this because they feel very passionately about getting to know people and learning about them and learning about who you are and how your values developed and what your background is, and then helping you clarify your goals and really discover, you know, what you want to do with yourself through this process. So we have a very low client-to-consultant ratio for a couple of reasons. One is so the consultant has the time to get to know you that well, and then two, just to have a good response time on doing your work with you. That said, you know, you have a personal consultant, but we have a large extended team. So you can, you know, leverage other members of the team. So, you know, I went to Stanford. Let's say you're working with a consultant who went to HBS and you have some Stanford-specific questions about your essays or something like that. I'm happy to look at them, you know. So we do use the whole team, and we have a very comprehensive consultant database that we've developed, so tools, as, you know, as we've trained our consultants as they come on how to do this process. I already said we kick it off with a structured marketing strategy so that you have a plan as you go through everything. And then we also have a really a client on an online resource center that's client only, with a lot of sample essays, sample recommendations, interview questions that we keep up every year that our clients help us with. So that's our approach. Come on up. So this is like the hurricane naming, right? If we did Charles. Who do we have now? But it's a dude. So, David, come join me. I love, the stools. This is like NBA GMAT storytellers behind the music. Yeah, unplugged. Please. Right. When I thought about my first essay. Okay, David.
Hi.
So you went to Villanova.
Yep.
Yeah, and you majored in finance.
Yeah.
And you've got 3-4. Okay, and you've been working for a few years at a large consulting firm, just mm-hmm. doing financial analysis.
Yep.
Okay. 670, good score. Target Harvard, Stanford, UCLA, any rhyme or reason to that?
Well, I'm actually from LA, okay. So I've got sort of a wish they all could be California thing going.
I understand.
Going. So, yeah. So I'm not totally sure yet, to be honest, about schools.
Okay. Okay, well, why don't you tell me a little bit about your background? You said you grew up in L.A. Did you have brothers, sisters?
Brothers. I'm the middle of three kids. Three boys. Yeah,
oddly exactly. Overachieving for the middle child.
Yeah,
that's
yeah,
sort of a
you know.
Thing.
Go middle.
Don't tell my middle brother.
Yeah,
right. Okay.
Exactly.
And did you live with both of your parents when you were growing up?
Actually, no. I lived with, we were raised by my mom.
You were raised by your mom.
Yeah, so, okay. But, yeah, my dad wasn't really around, but, I mean, I don't know. He wasn't really part of our life.
Okay.
Lives,
so your mom raised you.
Yeah, yeah.
Working mom, working hard.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. Mom is great.
Yeah.
So yeah, actually, we didn't have a whole lot, as you can imagine. I went to the local school, local grade school and middle school, and then I got into.
Where'd you go to high school?
I got into a Jesuit school there that was well. I worked my way all the way through it. I mean, I paid for it.
Oh, okay. So you're working throughout high school.
So yeah, I was like,
and then also involved with school in terms of teams or things like that.
Yeah, yeah. I played soccer for the school, but I think I was the only kid in my class probably who was like working to pay for the school.
What was that like?
I don't know. There were a lot of kids that were different, but I was really it was interesting because there were like. There were the Jesuits who I was really impressed by. I mean, I wasn't raised Catholic, but I was very impressed by their ideals and their commitment
to.
How
so? What in particular?
Well, they're really dedicated to social justice and to. Serving the poor and really changing the world. So, and there were a number of the Jesuits who really lived that, and I was very impressed by that. And actually, a lot of my classmates sort of didn't embody that. So I don't know, maybe I got more into certain aspects of the school, I did a lot of outreach in the community with projects that the priests ran. And
That's great.
Yeah.
It sounds like that was important to you. That was a
Yeah, it was. It was. It was like, you know, because I don't know, like I could, I don't want to psychoanalyze the whole thing, like, you know, father figure,
yeah,
all that stuff. But yeah, because like, so my dad wasn't around. So, you know, these fathers.
They were big role models,
right. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Well, yeah, there are a couple that I still stay in touch with. So,
yeah,
but
you were lucky,
you know,
to
so.
Have that. When you went to college, then how did you choose Villanova?
Well, I got it. Well, actually, it's Augustinian, but it's also Catholic. They influenced me, and I got a scholarship. I got a soccer scholarship,
okay.
So I played. I played soccer there, and that's pretty much what I did. I mean, when you have like a full ride.
Yeah.
Like that's
like
what you're going to do.
Right.
That's
yeah.
what you're going to do. And you're gonna work out in the off season and yeah. do all that stuff. And so that's what I did. And then,
and you still did well in school. So that was great.
Yeah.
I
I was
really
like focused. That was one thing that I learned from the Jesuits was focus. So
that's great. And so after Villanova, while you were at college, so soccer, homework, and
that
not
was
so
it.
Much with the service.
Yeah, that was pretty much.
Yeah,
well,
I
didn't really have any
time to do that. Yeah,
didn't really have time.
And so then you've been here in New York.
And pretty busy.
And I imagine just working.
Working, and there's some travel, so I really don't, you know.
True, with consulting. I remember it not so fondly myself. Great. Yep. Okay, so let's talk a little bit about why you're going to business school.
To advance my career.
Oh, what a lovely answer. And what do you mean by that? Do you have any sense of what you want to do afterwards? Not so
well,
much.
It's sort of the natural next step.
Natural, like most of your friends are applying.
Yeah, it's sort of like I've been doing this for, you know, 3 years, and I just want to, you know, move to the next level.
Right, take it to the next level. Right.
Right.
So if you could do anything, if you could do anything, business school or not, what would be of interest, you know, career-wise? If you could, how would you want to spend your days? What do you like doing? Huh. What do you like about your current job?
Well, I like certain aspects of what we do. I don't like so much that we work with huge, huge corporations.
Uh-huh.
I don't actually even like working for a huge, huge corporate firm. I see that we help companies. And so that's actually kind of cool. But I'd rather like it be a smaller environment, like smaller, the firm I'm with, like maybe, I don't know, maybe even have my own like financial consulting or analysis. I don't know even like if those things exist. In the ideal world, I guess that would be what I'd have. And it would be like, I'd have my set of clients and like help small businesses, like smaller businesses than, you know,
more
giant.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like as opposed to being like a tiny cog or something.
Yep.
So.
Yeah. What and what do you do outside of work?
I play adult league soccer.
Oh, nice.
So that's kind of, I guess, a theme. Can I use that as a theme?
Yeah. Yes,
soccer
you've been
player.
Soccer player.
Yeah, I really like soccer, and so like, but I mean, it's not like, I don't know. I guess I'd play for the soccer team in business school or something, or I would want to.
Right.
But,
that's great.
You know,
they would want
so,
to hear about that.
But
anything else that you're up to?
Nope.
Okay.
Pretty much.
So, okay, I'm gonna go ahead and stop David and just talk to the room rather so because we're getting up there on time. So rather than tease it out, I'm gonna cut to the chase. So one of the things that this was a real person that I worked with, though names in undergrad institutions have been changed. But one of the things that came out was he was really reluctant to talk about some of the difficult stuff that had happened in his past. And you know, there's actually a much larger story around his dad and everything. But the point is that you know many of us have been through. You know, difficult things, and no one has any interest in writing a sob story or, you know, a pity party story about themselves. But what is interesting is what you've learned from those experiences and what your takeaways are. And you'll see often, I'm really pleased to see a lot of, with the essays this year, that they'll ask, you know, tell me about, you know, your mistake and what did you learn? And that's really giving you a huge clue in those essays. I know when I read, you know, zillions of essays for Teach for America, you wanted to see the reflection from people. So I really want to emphasize that what the actual incident is less important than what you've taken away from that and how that's changed your life. And some of these things that may have happened in your past that seem, you know, like you don't want to drag them up or bring them up, those can be really big value shift moments in your life. And when we're all up here saying, you know, schools want to get to know you, who you are, they want to know what your values are and how those developed and who the, you know, major players and characters were in your life that made those things happen and what were the pivotal moments, the sort of decision moments where, you know, your life changed course of direction. So think a lot about, you know, where you've been and who you are, and don't think that your example is either too sad or not sad enough. It's your story. And what's really interesting about your story is what you've learned from your life. So that's one bit. The second thing that really came out with him is he had no real idea of what he wanted to do. And I get that a lot. Or when people will call, I'm often the person that talks to all the initial folks that contact Stacey Blackman. People will start telling me their sort of like business school story of what they want to do. But I really just want to know what you want to do. You know, if you're not thinking about, you know, running in an application, what do you really want to do with your life? You know, what's a group of people that you hope to impact? What's a place in the world that you want to change? I mean, just really thinking very broadly about yourself as a leader. And it doesn't need to be, you know, again, that you're going to change the world or save the world, but really think about who you want to impact and what the difference is going to be for you having been here. And that could be, you know, a very small thing of starting your own firm or a very large thing of, you know, doing, I don't know, whatever. So really trying to think honestly about what's important to you and having your values then reflected into your career goals, basically. The third bit was he was interested in doing something else other than playing soccer, though what everyone was saying here about how, you know, the film club and soccer, those things should all be on your application, yoga, whatever it is, that's who you are, and they want to know who you're going to be on their campus and how you're going to change their campus and what kind of classmate you're going to be. So all that stuff is very important. It doesn't have to be community service. But service had been really important to this person, and it had gotten away from his life. And something I know Chris and I have even talked about is business school applications are a really good time of taking stock in your life and looking at, you know, if you think about your day as a pie or your week as a pie and how you spend, you know, what are the pieces of that pie and how you spend your time, it's a good moment to, especially in that year before you apply, to be like, does my life actually reflect what's important to me? And for him, he had really lost touch with something that had been huge to him, which was this service work he had done in high school. And so we talked a lot about how he could get reengaged in that. And, you know, a lot of people will pick up an activity in that year before they apply to business school. And what schools want to see is that that activity or that service is connected to a previous interest you had in your life or connected to your background in some way. It's not just something random that you've selected. So that there is some sort of meaning. And he could really, you know, go back to what he had done in high school, but then we tried to invigorate it with some of his current skills. So he ended up, we searched for a bunch of different nonprofits in LA, and we found this one that was great that did small business advising for entrepreneurs. And by entrepreneurs, I mean mostly people who had just gotten out of prison or who were homeless or who had just left rehab. So he was helping them set up their own businesses, basically selling jewelry. I mean, very small scale, but it was really it became a very big part of his life just in the few months before he applied to school, and he ended up writing a lot of essays about it, and then it really ended up shaping what his career goals were. So if you find something to get involved with that actually is of genuine interest to you, it's going to impact, you know, your application, but more importantly, your whole life, you know. And the idea is not to do things for your application, but to do things to enhance your life and live more of the life of who you are. Now I'm sounding like a yoga teacher, but it's true. And then thus, then, you know, you will be a more interesting applicant. So he got really into the idea that, you know, small businesses are a major employer in the United States and most of them fail. And what could he do to help them, you know, with the financial skills and an MBA? And so that ended up being what he was really looking at to do after school. So, you know, you put together this application and you think, all right, what can I do to make sure everything lines up? I would just encourage you to like start taking stock of your life and try to make it line up, and then your application will reflect who you actually are. In terms of school choice, that was another thing with him of like maybe UCLA. So he did apply to those schools, but we talked a lot about other schools. And And, you know, helped him think through times to go on some school visits and what to do on the school visits and what questions to ask. And frankly, the thing applicants ask me most is what they should wear on their school visit. So we discussed that as well. And he really fell in love with Tuck. I mean, he fell in love with Tuck, and he was about to get married, and his fiance fell in love with Tuck. So he applied there early. And now is starting at Tuck. Though UCLA offered him tons of money, but he really wanted to go to Tuck. So, yeah, I think that that's it. Oh, okay, strategies. Combine your current skills and your forgotten passions, and then try to enhance your life. Yeah, that's what I said. Good, it all worked out in the end. Okay, thanks.
So, why don't we keep the mic over there, sort of in the middle, and I'll moderate questions at this point to anyone or all of the panel. Please, go ahead.
So, like, there's this option where you could put down if, you know, like, what race you are. Like, do we have to put them down, you know, as in, like, an Asian male or something else?
Basically the idea that, you know, you're a white male, you're an Asian male, you're applying to school, and you see the box, and it says optional, check your race, and you say, well, I'm not going to check that, because then I'll definitely get in, you know, because they're going to not know that I'm overrepresented in the pool. It doesn't really work that way. I mean, because anyone who is a minority that's in an underrepresented group is going to check the box. And so you should just be, I mean, you might as well share your personal information with the schools. There's no, I would not advise sort of strategizing around that. I don't know if people just, there may be other points of view on that, but.
Or by the interview.
Other questions?
Hi. I saw a lot on the, I guess, in the presentations and online and stuff that when you say your future career goals, everyone seems to have this targeted position at some place. Or how general can you be in what your future, like, short-term career goals? Because I see people, you know, I want to work at this position at this place, but I mean, I'm not sure I know that specific.
Yeah, I think that's a good question. I think that the schools want to know that you have a sincere ambition, and, you know, that can often be manifest in a specific position, but no one's going to, you know, penalize you for saying, you know, a firm alike and offering, you know, a few selections. And I think that a lot of the schools are starting to recognize that question is somewhat absurd, and that very few people actually follow up with those goals. And you've got a situation where you've got a school like Harvard, which has now essentially made its career goals question optional, and is asking more about a career vision, talking about what's important to you and why, and moving towards kind of a broader based understanding of your career. And so, you know, I think it's tending to vary from school to school. Schools that say, you know, in a very hard way, you know, what are your short and long-term goals? I think that you need to be relatively specific for a post-MBA goal. And again, you know, that doesn't mean saying, you know, you're going to be the guy beside the guy on the left sitting at the desk, you know. But, you know, you want to have a position in mind, a field in mind, you know, specialty in mind, and show, more importantly, an understanding of what that position is. So if you just say, I want to be a consultant, or I want to be a banker, it's not going to do it. You still have to imbue that title with some meaning and show your sense of purpose in it, even if they are being specific. And then in the long term, if you're looking at a school that has short and long term goals, you can afford to be a little more general, but you really want to link those long term goals to your short term goals in some kind of way. You don't want them to be completely disparate goals, where in the short term, you know, you're a consultant, in the long term, you're, you know, whatever, you know, to use something. You know,
I actually did that in my application, and it hurt me really badly. I was a high school teacher, and I talked about going back to business school to become a management consultant so I could get into the entertainment industry. Honest truth, I don't know what I was smoking. It led to a lot of wait lists or flat out dings. So. Yeah.
Anyone else wants to elaborate?
No, I think that was a good point.
One other just add-on is that the schools are looking for candidates to arrive prepared for the program, and so they have this sense that if you have a vision or a goal, and it does depend on the school, that if you arrive knowing what that vision is, you're going to be able to take better advantage of what the school has to offer you, and you won't be constantly faced with sort of, do I take that elective or do I take this one? Do I go to see McKinsey speak at 7 p.m. or do I go to the Goldman lecture? You know, so you really do, there is that sense that if you have a vision and you show up at school, you'll be better served by the degree. Yeah.
I think there was one.
If you were to say for your post-MBA plans, like say entrepreneur, right, and does the admissions board, when they see that, do they think, oh, he might not have a job right when he graduates, so that's kind of a negative on his part because, you know, maybe he's starting a business and on our stats, that's not a job? Is that a clear question?
Is your question, does admissions...
So if in your career vision or your career essay you say, maybe I want to, you know, I'm thinking about doing entrepreneurship or starting a business, does in the admissions board's eyes, do they see that as a possible negative because that's a stat that's not going to have necessarily a job offer that they can put in their statistics?
I think you have to look at the school. There are some schools that have that are known to be great entrepreneurship schools. There are schools that you have folks who are graduating and starting companies with each other and classmates. You have schools that are not necessarily known for entrepreneurship. I think you have to sort of be sensitive to where you're going, but more than that is about your background. What is it in your background that shows that you are going to be an entrepreneur, that this is something that they should take seriously? You know, are you coming from an entrepreneurial family, or have you actually started something? It's not even about the size of the company that you started or what you've started, but that you've got a track record doing something entrepreneurial. So they've got to believe you first before they buy the story.
Hi, thanks very much, guys. I was wondering, what's the common perception of somebody who has switched around in careers a little bit, who's jumped around from, and maybe had several different jobs?
Yeah, there is that. The fear is that if you've got this track record of bouncing around, are you going to commit to their program? Are you going to find a job when you graduate? But I think as long as you can explain and find that thread that you might be able to weave, you know, I learned X at this job, and then that led me to job B because I was then able to add Y to my portfolio of knowledge. So if you can weave a thread, I think it's okay. It's not ideal. I mean, they would like to see candidates who are spending, you know, at least 1-2 years in a job before they move on. But it's something you can overcome.
I have the apparently stereotypical problem of being a female history major from a small NESCAC school who has lower math than verbal scores in her GMAT. And I don't think I have time. I'm hoping to hit first round applications to take a class. Is there anything else that you can suggest in order to kind of rectify that problem?
Should I take this inside? I would just say that, I mean, first thing I would say is why do you feel this need to apply in round one? I mean, you're an underrepresented group in the applicant pool, just as a woman with like a liberal arts background. And so part of me is saying, why not spend this fall taking a class and showing the committee that you do have prompt skills and then applying round two? I mean, that's the first thing that comes to my mind.
I just want to also say that, you know, that I was, you know, women's studies, I'm your, yeah. You know, but my GMAT fit what the rest of my profile was. So in some cases, they're like, okay, that, you know, makes sense, as opposed to the other one we saw where it didn't make sense that you would have such a low math. So it's not necessarily a horrible thing there with that. And just just, you know, for the people that are quant week, know that, like, when I got into Stanford and Harvard, I also got a nice invitation to math camp at both of those schools before it began. So that's, I mean, it's a reality, and, you know, they know that in our group.
Just following up on that question regarding round one and round two, say of the top 10 schools, which have the most meaningful difference in admission rates between round one and round two?
Columbia is probably the most notable, considering they have an early decision round. So, you know, they're attempting to, in my opinion, play some games with their yield and possibly, you know, ferret out a few candidates that might have otherwise gone to Wharton or Harvard. But other than that, I mean, most of the other schools are at pains to say that that the rounds are essentially equal, and well, candidates will never believe them.
Yep.
I do.
Yeah.
When I was at HBS, we would get applications. There was no fundamental difference between round one and round two, and that's not just an HBS thing. It's across the top business schools. Round three, on the other hand.
Yeah.
Is a major problem. If you're thinking round three, you better be someone who's coming from a non-traditional background based out of Kuala Lumpur.
Yeah.
I mean, I will add one caveat is that if you belong to kind of an oversubscribed group, let's say you're an Indian male with an undergrad degree in engineering, and then you've come to state school in the States for a master's in engineering, and you work in IT or something, okay? That's one overrepresented group in the pool, the same way that a white investment banker might be one. There could be benefits to being early. I mean, when you apply in round one, you're not competing against all those other investment bankers that they've already admitted, you know, as you would be in round two. So, and actually, we did see at Wharton a slight difference in the acceptance rate between round one and round two. So it's on the margin, and I think that if you're not an overrepresented group, you shouldn't care about this at all. But if you are, you may want to apply in the first round, assuming you can craft an application that's going to be compelling. You know, don't rush it to get it in. It's not worth it.
Basically, being one of the major represented ones, so how can I differentiate? I mean, in sense, like, how can these people, like, you know, the Indian guy who's coming from here and did the master's with the background in computers, how can we differentiate? I mean, what are the kind of things you try to put together to differentiate these kind of people?
Is the question how do you differentiate yourself?
No, I'm telling, like, you know, he mentioned that it's white male in investment banking is the same as the Indian guy working in computer, and, you know, how we kind of differentiate people. Differentiate in sense, like, what are the kinds of things which you bring unique to these people? I'm just...
Well, I mean, everyone's different, right? I mean,
everyone
has a unique story.
And I'm telling... my question is, like, how do you portray themselves? Like, you know, how do you project the student? Like, you know, he's basically from the same thing, but he's good in this thing, that thing, and basically in extracurricular activities, or how, just.
Right, I mean, you're gonna tell your story, and you're gonna search for ways in which you stand out. So, you know, maybe you're the best investment banker at your company, and then you've got accolades to back that up, or maybe it's that something you do with your spare time, or anything about your background. I mean, we just saw a set of cases where candidates had grandfathers who were French, whose books they'd read, you know, companies in the textile business. I mean, there are all kinds of things that could make you different. I think that, yeah, there's a burden placed on you when you fall into this overrepresented pool to really kind of ferret that stuff out. But, I mean, if that's the question you're asking, it's just you've got to dig and try and find what it is that makes you unique. I mean,
and one easy way to do that is to look beyond your professional experience. Figure that all the IT... Indian males are going to be talking about the project that they worked on, or some software that they created, or some code, right? But you have to ask yourself, what else have you done? You know, it could be, I worked with a client who was from India, and he talked about how it was important to him in his school to help the female students to be on equal terms. He talked about how there was some different treatment of female classmates, where the guys would get to use the lab at a certain time and the women didn't get access, and how he sort of lobbied and pushed through his leadership initiative to make that happen. That's a differentiating standpoint in terms of, you know, equality and fairness. And again, that's just one example. There's a million different examples you can use, but you have to be authentic and pull something from your personal story
Yeah, I think applicants are often surprised at how personal the application should be, not just in terms of even what you reveal about yourself and your life, but, you know, but also your personality. Like, let your sense of humor come through, you know, what you find poignant, what you find interesting. I mean, when I was reading all of those essays at Teach for America, like, please give me a laugh, you know, give me something, entertain me. Like, that really needs to come through. So I think applicants are always like, okay, I need to appear, and I've done, yeah. But let your personality shine through. And like, you know, Graham's saying, everyone in this room is a different personality, so that's a big part of differentiating yourself.
If I could add one last comment, you know, you look at a lot of the questions, you know, Duke, Kellogg, Darden all have the same question now about your background, values, and leadership experiences. You know, Stanford asks what's most important to you and why. These are not just opportunities to talk about, you know, your background is not your professional background. Your values are not your professional values. Your, you know, leadership experience is not exclusively the domain of your professional experience. And so they really do fundamentally, this is not just a cliche, they really do want to get to know you. And your values are informed by experiences that are quite different than others. And, it, you know, it's just, I mean, I think we're all saying the same thing. Really explore, you know, really explore, because you're not just a Indian technology engineer. You're an Indian technology engineer who, you know, might have been a phenomenal you know, older brother or classmate, whatever the example was, who also has an interest in, you know, X sport or, you know, whatever. There's, you're the sum of more than just your professional experiences.
You still have to talk about the professional experience.
You do, yeah.
But you can also find unique elements within that. So, you know, based on the industry you're serving or a project that required you to travel to China in order to manage an international team or even to work from here with international, you know, teams.
Or effective mentorship on a project that might be about, you know, about technology, but you're not necessarily, you don't need to talk about the computer language. You can talk about how you taught others or how you put together a cohesive team or how you overcame an obstacle, whatever
it
might be.
Can it be 50-50 between like... let's keep the interesting question. People waiting back for questions. Do a couple more, and then I think probably the panelists will stay around to answer individual questions. So.
Sure. Just hypothetically, right? you know, again, it has to do with your story. You know, that's a tremendous advantage. You know, there aren't a lot of PhDs applying to school, especially with that kind of specialized experience. The question is, how is it tied in to your future goals? You know, they're going to want to know why, after all this education that you've gone through, you know, why you're making that change now. And there should be some sort of connection, obviously, to, you know, commercial connection to what you're doing. And there are, you know, I mean, there are, you know, there are programs that are going to, you know, I would assume that if you're at that point in your career, you know, the idea of taking, say, you know, a master's degree in biology, you know, simultaneously with your Wharton MBA, which is possible, probably wouldn't be appealing to you. So the question is, what kind of advanced degree, if I'm understanding your second part of the question correctly, what kind of advanced degree would work with an MBA in addition to a PhD? But as long as you can create the connections, there's certainly no problem with that, and you'd probably be a welcomed, you know, very distinct addition to a classroom.
One note about PhDs is that I find it hard to believe that you would have no sort of leadership or work experience, because you must have done some TAing or worked in a lab with a team. And so you need to sort of cast those experiences as, you know, your PhD experience as somewhat the equivalent of a work experience. And then obviously, I mean, you know, if you are in the sort of bio field, I mean, you might look at a program that has a really strong focus on biotech or healthcare management. And there are a number, Kellogg, Wharton, Duke, that all kind of have offerings in those areas. So.
Okay, let's just do one last question.
Wharton last year, and I plan to I don't think so.
I mean, do you live in New York?
I live in New York, and I don't have an education
base. And you, right. If you, I would say if you get an interview,
yeah.
Go to Wharton. No, I mean, go to the school for the interview, as opposed to doing it with an alum from Philly. Why would you do an alumni interview here? You know, why not go to campus? And so, but in terms of revisiting, no, I wouldn't go back into, I mean, you should have enough, assuming you have enough data that you've gathered in terms of, you know, to fill out your applications. And yeah, don't waste your time going back a second time. No.
Because everybody's like, go back to diversity.
You don't have to. No.
I'm a little bit nervous of going first. I think I'm nervous.